Welcome to Songcraft. I'm Paul Duncan.
And I'm Scott B. Bomar. You're listening to Find Your People, written and recorded by our guest on this episode of Songcraft, Drew Holcomb.
You gotta find your people, the ones that make you feel all right. The kind you want to stay up with all night.
Memphis native Drew Holcomb first broke through on the national scene with the 2011 album Chasing Sunday, credited to his band Drew Holcomb and the Neighbors. Subsequent studio albums such as Good Light, Medicine, Souvenir, and Dragons hit the top 10 on Billboard's folk and indie charts and earned Holcomb and his bandmates a loyal following. The fiercely independent group is widely regarded as a live performance powerhouse, while Holcomb's original songs have found particular resonance with music supervisors who have made them staples of film and TV show sync placements. Whether working with the band, solo, or as a duo with his wife and fellow singer-songwriter Ellie Holcomb, Drew's literate, folk-based Americana represents a craftsman's approach to the songwriting process. The most recent album from Drew Holcomb and the Neighbors is called Strangers No More.
Part 1.
Well, Paul, a couple weeks back, you and I had a bit of a shared experience that we actually did not share at all. Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band were here in Inglewood, California, City of Champions, world headquarters of Songcraft, Spotlight, and Songwriters. And he played a show on a Thursday night, and then he played a second show on a Sunday night. I was at Sunday, you were at Thursday. We both were collectively blown away.
Yeah. Yeah. I a little disappointed that we couldn't get him to come over because, I mean, right down the road.
Right. Know, yeah.
Just a few miles away.
So close.
What an incredible show. And you and I have both seen Bruce before. Saw him once together, actually, on that Seeger Sessions tour.
Yeah.
And then I saw him at the Sports Arena a couple years after. And it's always a beautifully exhausting experience. I mean, Bruce plays every song, not only like it's the last song of the show, but like it's the last song of his life.
Yeah.
I feel like he just, and, you know, aged completely defied. Humanity, anything about his physical being was just set aside for the sake of the music. If the man was tired, you'd never know it.
Right.
If he came off a year of having peptic ulcer disease, which he did, you'd never know it.
Right.
Unbelievable show.
Unreal. He's what, 74?
Something like that.
Yeah. I mean, he's got more energy at 74 than I have ever had.
Yeah.
At any point in my life. And it is so at the show that I went to. And the other thing about Bruce is he varies the set list. It's not the same show every night. At the one I went to, the band came out and they played Open All Night from the Nebraska album, which that album is almost entirely acoustic. And that song is actually the only song that's electric on the album. But on the album, it's just an electric guitar and Bruce, and it's very stripped down.
Yeah.
He comes out with an 18-piece band, including the horn players and the backup singers, and does this like rollicking, just rave up, like insanely energetic version. And it took me a minute to even recognize what song I was hearing.
Right.
But the energy level that they came out with was just, it was electric. It was exciting, but it never let up.
I've also noticed that Bruce says all night a lot. He'd prove it all night.
right.
I was there kind of early in the set, which I think he wants to let you know we're going to play all
we're
night.
We're going all night. And he did, I think you said he went close to 3.5 hours at your show. He did about 3 hours and 15 at ours. And I'm like, what does slowing down look like for this guy? Jeez. Was at some point we're going to be like, yeah, he only played 2 hours.
Well, what's crazy too, people talk about no breaks, right?
Yeah.
And there was no encore. It's not like he even left the stage or came back. He just stayed up the whole time. But not only were there no breaks, like traditional breaks, he didn't even stop between songs. Like a song would be hitting its final chord.
Yeah.
And he starts counting in the next 1, 2, 3. And you're like, my gosh.
Yeah.
No water.
Right.
Not a sip of water.
Yeah. He absolutely just wall to wall, energetic, nonstop music. It was crazy. The night that I was there, he did Ghost of Tom Joad. He did the song American Skin, 41 Shots, which he brought out Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine. And that was like a shock. But then they go into Ghost of Tom Joad, which is another song that's an acoustic song, but not in this version. And Tom Morello comes up and it was still out there from his, you know, the previous song. And at the end of Ghost of Tom Joad, Tom and Bruce get into this sort of back and forth, like guitar slinger, you know, one-upmanship, and you forget that Bruce can shred.
Bruce can play, and, you know, the night I was there, I was noticing, I said, man, he's playing more leads than Little Steven and Nils combined.
Yeah.
Like, Bruce was, like, the lead guitarist in the band for the most part. And you look at the E Street Band, and they're obviously there because they're fabulous musicians. I mean, right. Everybody's great at what they do. They're also there because their presence matters.
Yeah.
You know, having little Steven up there next to him sharing a microphone is just, it's part of the visual. It's part of the sound. Even their voices together, which isn't like this Lennon McCartney tight harmony.
Right.
It's just they're barking at each other, you know, in a kind of harmony.
Right.
But just having them up there, you know, it would feel like a lesser show.
Yeah.
If little Steven wasn't there.
Yeah.
And same thing with Max Weinberg and same thing with Nils. And you know, Patty came out for a song or two. And like, I don't know, you have this feeling that you're there for the entire family.
Right. It's part of the family reunion.
Yeah. And not just for Bruce, but you're also really just there for Bruce because all eyes are on Bruce.
Right.
You know.
Bruce kind of goes into this sort of revival preacher thing at times,
for sure.
Where he's just like, you know, getting everybody worked up, and I'm sure he did this at the show you were at too, but he gets into this like rapid fire thing, and I don't remember what all he was saying, but as part of this long rapid fire introduction of the band, he says something about like, we're the earthquake and love making Viagra taking E Street Band, which I think is funny that he's willing to, you know, sort of make a joke about we're getting older. But you would not have guessed that any of these people were getting older just from the sheer level of energy. And the other thing that I noticed and that blows my mind is I looked this up when I got home. Bruce has had 12 top 10 hits as an artist. And at the show I was at, he played 3 of them.
Yeah.
And I don't know of any other artist who just ignores most of their hits, but also leaves the fans satisfied. And
right.
I never hear anybody be like, man, I went to a Bruce show and I'm like, I didn't know any of the songs. I didn't like it. Even if people aren't familiar with the songs, they love the show.
Yeah.
And I think about like, I'll hear people be like, man, we went to see Bob Dylan. He didn't play any of his well-known songs.
And he might have. You just
right? And you're like, well, yeah, that's kind of his thing.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know that? Like, that's like, by now, if you're a music fan, you should sort of know, like, you don't know what you're going to get with Dylan. And I'm surprised by the number of people I hear complain about that. They kind of go like, you know, but I never hear that with Bruce. And it's because he's such a showman. He is such a showman that no one cares.
I also think that Bruce has done such a great job over the years of kind of redefining what a hit means to his fan base.
Yeah.
You know, there are songs off the records, you know, Atlantic City feels like a hit.
Yeah.
It feels like a part of the canon
to
the Bruce's listenership.
Yeah.
But that's not a song that was, you know,
right. And in fairness, like Born to Run, 10th Avenue Freeze Out, Thunder Road, none of those were top 10 hits.
Right.
So a lot of these songs are classics.
Right.
But, you know, it's hard to imagine that with Bruce having like Born in the USA being his biggest hit of all time, I've seen him play it acoustic. I've never seen him play it with the band, and I don't think he really does ever.
Right. Well, it's such a misinterpreted song.
I don't know if he
wants to continue to contribute to that.
right. But how crazy to think, like, what other artist can get away with ignoring, you know, the majority of their biggest
hits?
There's
not many.
And everybody loves it.
You will walk away from a Stone show and think about 10 songs they could have played, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not because they're not playing Start Me Up.
Right.
Like, they are playing,
right,
you know, the songs that you expect, that you've heard on the radio. They're going to do them.
Yeah.
They're just probably going to leave out 2 or 3 of them.
Right.
Bruce is leaving out 75%.
Majority of his biggest hits.
Which is crazy. I mean, I think at times I've gone to see U2, and I think U2 has a little bit of that with their fan base where, like, they played Running to Stand Still. You know, people are more excited about that than hearing Beautiful Day Again.
Yeah.
But again, U2's going to give you Where the Streets Have No Name.
Yeah.
They're going to give you Beautiful Day. Bruce is almost doing a Radiohead thing where they're not going to come out and play Creep.
Right.
Spoiler alert for anybody that's going to see Radiohead. They're not going to play Creep. Bruce is almost like living in that area, which I don't know of anybody from the 70s who does that.
And I think that almost, you know, the part of the Bruce thing, I mean, on Bruce's website, after he plays a show, they put the set list up because it's a thing. You know, like, what's he gonna play? And I love that. Like, I love the idea that, like, and watching him too, you're watching a guy and you're like, this is a band leader. You know, a lot of like big musicians, like, somebody in the band is sort of the designated band leader. It might be the keyboard player, it might be a guitarist, whatever, but if you're watching, like, they're the one kind of conducting things.
Right.
And the star is out front, like, doing their thing. Bruce is counting off every song. Bruce is like, in fact, in the very first song, they come out and the piano player started a little too fast. And Bruce was like, motioning him, and he sort of like backed off the intensity, like the volume.
Yeah.
And then Bruce was like, shook his head a little bit and like this to like let him know I'm talking about tempo.
Yeah.
And he did slow down the tempo, and then the rest of the band came in, and you know, he's signaling Max like when to do a stop. Like he is the band leader. And so the fact that you have a guy who's so into live music that not only is he changing up the set list every night, he's not relying on somebody else in the band to sort of make sure everybody knows their cues and knows their parts. He's taking that on, too.
And what that tells me is don't be in a hurry looking for when Bruce is going to retire, because that guy does it because he loves it.
Right.
You know, he's absolutely deeply invested in every piece of the show.
Yeah.
Every part of the fabric of it. We have a friend, Marty, who played with Bruce for a while, and he was, you know, told us that kind of stuff, that Bruce is just very, very invested on everything.
Yeah.
And it's fun to see that, you know. I think we like thinking that all of our heroes are that way.
Yeah.
And some of them don't even go to rehearsal.
Right.
So some of them are in a bathtub filled with caviar somewhere while someone is doing a stand-in for them at rehearsal, where Bruce is out there really doing the thing.
Yeah, yeah. I saw a thing a few days after the shows he did here where he was playing in New Jersey, and he posted a thing on social media where he got a flat tire on the way to his show and still managed to be on time. And the post
changed it myself.
Did not explicitly say if he changed it himself, but I kind of want to believe he did. Totally. I kind of feel like, I mean, Bruce is certainly a guy who seems like he could change a tire.
Right. Well, he's sang a lot about getting up under that hood a bunch of times.
Right.
So if you found out he couldn't, what a disappointment.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, no, but I
is it Lefty Lucy?
I want to believe that Bruce changed that tire and got himself to the show on time, because he's just, you know, he just seems like a very cool, down-to-earth, regular kind of guy who also is blessed with the ability to put on an unbelievably entertaining show.
Yeah. Well, I, for one, was really glad that we got to see him. And, you know, to see that dynamic between him and the band, it reminds me a bit of when we talked to Drew Holcomb about Drew Holcomb and the Neighbors, which is, you know, it's Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, Drew Holcomb and the Neighbors. And, you know, the impression that I got from Drew is that this is a real team. It's a real team of brothers. And yet he's the driving force and the writer and the kind of creative center of the band.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, Tom Petty and Bruce Springsteen have put out music like that's just under their name.
Right.
And then they've put out music that's their name and the band. And, you know, Drew has done that some as well, like with his wife. They've put out music, you know, that's just under their name and other things. And I always find it interesting of people where their name is the first part of the band name, like what the distinction is necessarily in their mind of like, well, why, if you're the one writing the songs and you're the one, you know, like putting all this music out there, why do you draw a distinction in your mind between what is
a solo record versus a band?
Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, what it shows is an immense respect for your bandmates.
Yeah.
That, you know, that this is a certain thing that is set aside with this specific group of people. And no, if they're not part of it, then it's called a different thing.
Yeah. I think it's like acknowledging there's something sacred about a band.
Yeah.
There's something sacred about the time that everyone's put in together and the alchemy, you know, just what happens when people are put together creatively like that. It's always funny, I think, with Petty, because you go, well, Mike Campbell is kind of on everything, you know, and, you know, one day I really hope that we can talk to Stan Lynch, because I think Stan Lynch would be a great guy to give some insight into the ins and outs of those days. You know, another story for another day.
Right, right.
But there is something sacred about the band and about, and, you know, I'm not in the van when these guys are touring.
Right.
But there's like a, it's like a gang,
right?
It's like
something
that you can't break into from the outside,
right?
And it means something.
Yeah, I love the fact that Elvis Costello and the Attractions, and then later the band name changed to Elvis Costello and the Imposters, but only one band member changed. But it's like, well, because one guy got swapped out, it's not the same band, so we can't call it the same band because it's not the same band. I think that's fascinating.
Meanwhile, you got Lennon with the Plastic Ono Band, who's like, we're going to call it the Plastic Ono Band because I want to be able to change this band around at any point and any time. Right. It's plastic.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, we had a great conversation with Drew, and turns out, you know, he's a Nashville guy like we used to be in our growing up years. So a lot in common there. And it was a lot of fun to chat with him. So we're going to go ahead and let you guys hear that.
Part 2.
Drew, welcome to Songcraft.
Thanks for having me on. I'm thrilled.
We're going to talk about a lot of songs from the breadth of your career, but I want to start with the most recent. I want to talk about the song Suffering. Comes right out of the gate, man. I love the guitar sound. The riff just hits you right away. It kind of sounds to me like just a windows down type of song. It's a fun song, but the title's not very fun. So I'd love to talk to you about just that right away. The sort of the topic, the fact you're going to land on the word suffering over and over again in the chorus, but a song that just is so fun to listen to.
Yeah, I wrote that song after having a very sort of sad, but also a little bit humorous encounter with a woman who was living on the street who was yelling at a stranger for some sort of, driving infraction that impeded her walk downtown. And it was sad just because she was clearly very sort of strung out. But it was also kind of humorous because the things that she was saying were pretty funny. But it was one of those reminders of the human condition that we're sort of all in this together, and we're really, if we're not in her position, it's just a matter of like a few better breaks in our life. Mm. So I went home and sort of, it felt like that story needed to be told sort of inside the frame of a big rock and roll song. And so I just sort of started hammering on the A and, kind of in that sort of, I don't know, sort of angry, petty vibe.
Right.
And had that just all in this together. Yeah. 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 At the end of the chorus. And, I also knew it would be a great frame for my band to paint with. And, I'm very excited to play it live because it definitely has that. It was great to record in the studio. It was really fun to record in the studio, but it's definitely going to be a song that sort of elevates the room when you play it live. So I've always written with the live show in mind because that's where I fell in love with music was, I mean, I liked music, listening to the radio with my parents driving down the highway. I really fell in love with it when I started getting old enough to go see shows and experiencing that sort of magic thing that happens. But yeah, the windows down compliment is to me is like the ultimate songwriter compliment because it's, the music makes people want to sort of push pause on the rest of their suffering, if you will.
Yeah.
And go take a ride. And so I'll take that. I appreciate that.
Talking about writing for the live experience, I want to pursue that a little bit because I'm curious for you, do you kind of go away and write songs and you're kind of imagining how they would work in a live setting and you get those songs kind of honed down and then you present them to an audience? Or do you actually kind of workshop songs on the road where maybe you've got a song you're working on and you are playing that song live, and after playing it live a few nights you go, you know what, it needs a lift right here, it needs something else, so that almost the performance of the song becomes interactive with the songwriting process?
I used to write a lot more, I used to sort of tease songs a lot more live and test them. Now I only do that if I'm fairly confident that it's a strike, like right down the middle, that it's going to work. I think, and part of that is just because after doing this for 20 years, my catalog is relatively deep, and I've also want to sort of play the songs that I know people want to hear and the songs that we've already sort of built into something that we've already presented them in that space. The only exception to that is I'll typically do a couple of solo songs every night. And that's where I tend to sort of test a song, not because I don't want to test a song live with the band, because I feel like in a little ways that's a bit of a cheat, because a band can kind of make any song sound good enough. But if I can play a song by myself on the guitar and it resonates with people, then I know the song in and of itself is good enough to sort of pursue inside of the framework of the studio and putting it down on a record. So I do like to play songs, sort of test them out, but only solo. I just feel like that's a more fair and naked framework. One of my favorite shows that I ever saw was Christofferson played the Ryman, and he was solo acoustic. And this is, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago before his health declined. And he hardly said a word to the audience, which that wasn't necessarily that compelling, but he just played song after song after song after song, great song after great song with that needed no introduction. And that sort of created like a true north for me as far as what is a measure of a good song is, can you execute it live? Now, that's not totally fair in every genre. I mean, because certain songs lend themselves towards this big, collaborative sonic explorations. And if you didn't have that, the song itself might not be that great. But that's sort of the music that I tend to lean in towards, the stuff that if you strip it all away, is it good enough with just the artist and a piano or the artist and a guitar? And I sort of live, that's my sort of litmus test.
I want to talk about that. You mentioned being in the backseat of the car with your parents and hearing the music. I want to kind of go back there and talk about some of the formative influences you had. I'm just sitting here thinking, Scott and I, we've known each other for 30 something years, since about age 15. So for the most part, we listened to the same bands in high school, but we still turned out to be different guys in terms of our instincts, and I think those years before age 15, they may not be things that I am like actively referencing in the music I make these days, but I think they all kind of go in there to form who we are. So I'd be curious about, like, from the very beginning, some of the influences you heard that stuck, that are still a part of the music you make today, and some of the ones that people that listen to your music might not have any idea are somewhere in the mix.
That's a great question. I think a lot of that depended for me on I tended to ride in carpool as the young kid for a lot of years, and so there was a rotating cast of drivers, and a couple of them that were driving me around at the same time were three high schoolers. One was a young woman who loved to play like Mariah Carey and Celine Dion, and then the other guy loved to play like Rage Against the Machine and 311, and then my dad liked to play Bob Dylan, and my mom liked to play Amy Grant and Christian Radio. And then my favorite was my best friend's older brother mainly played The Cure and U2, and so there was all sorts of inputs, coming into my view and into my ears. And I think with that, and then another one, I remember my cousin used to always play country music, and mainly like George Strait and Alan Jackson. And at the time, my tastes were very much Pearl Jam, Blind Melon, as a sort of 13, 14, 15-year-old, was sort of that early era of 90s alternative radio stuff that was really, really good, really compelling. But my attention was turned in other directions, and I found myself, every once in a while, singing I'm Your Lady by Celine Dion at the top of my lungs with my carpool, just because it's like, why not, or what was that record that had so many good songs on it, the Aerosmith record with Crazy and Tryin', and that was one that was pretty regular in those formative sort of 12 to 15. But then, when you turn 16, then you get to be in charge, and oddly enough, your scope sort of narrows into what you choose to listen to, which for me was kind of more in that U2, Pearl Jam, frame. But then the songwriter stuff really around my junior year, Dylan, David Gray, Springsteen, sort of became kind of the centerpiece. And then you get married. I love Led Zeppelin, but I don't listen to Led Zeppelin anymore because my wife doesn't like it. She doesn't have anything against it. She just doesn't want it on. She just doesn't enjoy listening to it. So yeah, there's all these like moments in your life that sort of dictate a little bit of what, the inputs are. But I think once you start driving, that's when you get to be in charge of your music.
And if you weren't there in the 90s, I don't think people realize how parallel current music and classic rock were at the same time for us on the radio. Like, for me, Lynyrd Skynyrd might as well have been a new band. I listened at the same time as Smashing Pumpkins, because I think the classic rock format and radio really came into its own around that time. And so it
Yeah,
is.
because that stuff was like at its, 30 and 20-year-old sort
Exactly.
of perfect sweet spot. Yeah, and there was so much of it,
Yeah,
because
yeah.
all the recording technology blossomed, in the 60s and 70s. And
Yeah. And I would just like to commend your integrity and faithfulness as a husband to stay with a woman who does not appreciate Led Zeppelin. I think that's
it's tough, we all
commendable.
have our cross to bear.
Well, so Paul and I grew up in Nashville. You grew up right down the road in Memphis, and Memphis is such a music town, especially, I mean, rock and roll was kind of born there in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, huge blues town, huge R&B town. There's a lot of music kind of swirling around. For me, as a kid in Nashville, Memphis was kind of this exotic place to go. You know, I'd go to the Memphis in May festival, and I was just at the age where I got to hear some of the, like, you know, I got to hear Chuck Berry and B.B. King and people, like, right before they died. You know, it was sort of this magical time. For somebody who grew up there, it probably didn't seem quite as magical and mystical. It just seemed like, you know, the life you knew. But was there anything about Memphis in particular that you feel kind of impacted your sensibilities just from having grown up in that town as opposed to, say, somewhere in Indiana or wherever?
Yeah, I think the thing that I took most with me was this sort of independent chip on my shoulder sort of posture that I think pretty much everyone from Memphis has. It's a city that people love to sort of put down. It's a city that people don't, I don't think, who don't live there, aren't from there, don't really understand the city that well. And there obviously was this incredible amount of music history. Now, to be honest, in a lot of ways, I was just a normal kid born in the early 80s listening to whatever was on the radio. And so a lot of that had nothing to do with being from Memphis. I was having a similar music education as a kid was in Omaha or Seattle. But the live, you know, there was this reality that music sort of permeated culture in Memphis. There was all this history around Elvis and Stax and the blues, and people loved to come there and experience music and then barbecue, which were sort of hand in glove. I too went to the Beale Street Music Fest every year starting around age 13 or 14 and was exposed to, I'll never forget one year, Skinner was headlining on one stage and 3-6 Mafia was headlining the other stage at the same time. And I'm like, everybody's like, that sounds dangerous. I'm like, it was dangerous, but Memphis could pull it off because we lived in that tension all the time.
Wow.
Because that was sort of the mix of culture that you had in that city. And so I think the thing that I took away from Memphis that I brought with me to Nashville was an independent streak. I moved to Nashville, really kind of kicking and screaming, but I found this neighborhood that I loved, and my wife got a teaching job in East Nashville where we live. And I thought, okay, this neighborhood has a little grit to it, which is like, you know, grit and grind is sort of the Memphis, you know, ethos. And I found that in this neighborhood and eventually came to see that there was a ton of talent here that I didn't realize was how good it was. And there were a lot of people from Memphis here as well that I think moved here because the talent level is so high. And part of that was just that Memphis didn't have the sort of business infrastructure to support, which is the same reason Elvis left, you know, and started recording here in Nashville, you know, decades ago. So some of the same issues still remain for the city, but it does have a really rich soil for creativity, for independence. And I think I would say that's the thing I've carried with me the most. And it's allowed me to sort of chart my own way while everybody in town when I was young was telling me I needed to do things a certain way in order to succeed. And I knew that that wasn't my true north. And I was able to sort of stick with that because that was kind of how we were raised.
I'd like to kind of start to talk about the, you know, some of the early records that you started making after being at the University of Tennessee, after you met your bandmates, after you met your wife, and, you know, all those things in retrospect, they look like a perfectly woven path, but I'm sure at the time it all felt accidental and organic and what's happening. But, you know, anyone who sort of starts making music for the commercial space in the early 2000s, I think about all the changes that are happening right at the same time. You know, you're sort of raised in a world of records and radio. And then you find yourself entering this world of digital consumption a little bit, songs on television, and that as a player and how a song comes to life. And then now here we are in the age of streaming. But, you know, I think about the debut EP Lost and Found. You had your full-length Washington Blue. You're building, building, building. And, you know, even going up to the full-length Passenger Seat, I want to talk about TV in particular and how song placement on shows began to become a driver for just getting your music in front of people. How did that happen? Accidentally, organically? Did you sort of see that opportunity at the time, or how did that come about?
Yeah, it was complete accident. This was in the sort of heyday of MySpace when I first started releasing records. So my first full length record came out in 2005, and, you know, had a a presence on MySpace. I, at the time, probably had like 7 or 8 markets where I could sell 100 tickets. You know, I was still very, very young. I was playing bar gigs and cover songs and college, community college coffee shops all over the country. In the air, and from 2004 to 2009, I put 300,000 miles on a Volvo station wagon, traveling all around, playing wherever anybody would have me. And so I had enough sort of presence on MySpace to where it like would, you know, there was some sort of whatever algorithm existed at that point in time. And a guy reached out to me and I thought it was spam at first. He's like, "Hey, I help artists find TV pitching, you know, agents to, or agencies to help them. And I think your music would work well on TV." And he said, "If it happens, I get a cut." So I thought, okay, great. So I signed with this, first thing I ever signed with anybody was this one page agreement with this company. What I didn't know at the time was I was also signing a co-pub agreement. Oh. That if anything that they got placed, they got co-publishing on.
Yikes.
Found, you know, you learn the hard way. They weren't necessarily trying to be egregious. They told me to hire a lawyer, but I didn't have any money to hire a lawyer. So I just signed it. And then they immediately got me like a $4,000 placement on a show called Army Wives on Showtime, on Lifetime. Yeah. And, you know, all of a sudden that song on MySpace got a bunch of listens and it got some downloads on iTunes, which at the time was, iTunes was pretty brand new. And all of us artists were still, you know, having all these conversations about, oh, you can't, don't put your music on iTunes because then people stop buying your CDs, you know, because I was still, that was the primary way of getting music out was CDs. But obviously Napster had already existed and sort of disrupted everything. So it was a strange time. But then all of a sudden, I moved on quickly from that organization and found a different home once I moved to Nashville, that was a little more artist friendly. And they started, getting me on shows. And it was anything from Deadliest Sketch to House to, I mean, I honestly, there's like, we've been on like over 150 shows now in the last 20 years. But at the time it was like 2 or 3 a year. And it was, you know, all in the sort of lower 4-digit payouts, which was great. But then all of a sudden we got put on 2009. So about, you know, 5 years into making records, had a song called Live Forever that got picked up and put on NBC's Parenthood, which at the time was season 1 and it was blowing up. And there was this very emotional sort of 2-minute montage where the song was the entire audio of that scene. And the song shot up on the iTunes chart to like top 10 and number 1 on singer-songwriter and sold like 10,000 copies of the song over that weekend.
Sing me a song. Sing me a melody. Sing out loud. You're a symphony. I want you to live forever underneath the sky so blue.
At the same time, I couldn't get signed to a record label to save my life. There was just no place for me, you know. It's like, oh, you're too folky for majors, and all the indies were like, your music a little too mainstream for, you know, the Rounders type record labels of the world. Not picking on Rounder, I'm just using them as an example. I don't even remember if they ever said that to me. So just for clarity, but yeah, so it was like it was my radio. And it's continued to be that for me for many years. I mean, even up to this last month, we had the commercial for the NCAA March Madness thing, the song I have called Dance with Everybody. What's been really interesting is in that early era when I started having some success at that, for about a year, I started trying really hard to write in that space. Hmm. And then all of a sudden, it completely went away. And I gave up on trying to write for that space. And it was sort of an eye opener of, hey, you're chasing commercial success here and it's not working. What was working was writing from the heart and letting the chips fall. So I got back to that. And then it really sort of took off around a record, the song called Live Forever, and then a record called Good Light. And it's been really consistent. I think you also build relationships with these people. I've been out to LA a ton of times and met with the folks who pick songs, and a lot of them have become friends. And that sort of put in the work in the same way that other artists go visit all these radio stations.
Yeah.
That's been sort of where I've put in the extra elbow grease. And again, I still don't write for briefs. That's never been my thing.
Yeah.
But for some reason, my voice and the way I write and the way my band sounds seems to be a good fit for those sort of moments. And I'm, practically very grateful for that.
What's really interesting about the sort of the advent or the rise of TV as a driver in the popularity of music is, you think about MTV in the 80s, and artists started thinking about visuals and about what it meant to pair a visual to the music, and that became an important part of the way we consume music. We think about, you talk about those Aerosmith songs, and I can see the videos. They were Alicia
What was
Silverstone
the
bands.
movie? Armageddon,
Yeah,
Right.
exactly.
I don't want to miss a thing.
And to think that, like, you write a song and you put all of your efforts into it, and all of your instincts as a musician and in production come in there, and then a director takes all of their influences and all of their, powers and puts it together with a really powerful piece that can kind of marry so beautifully with the music in an artistic sense and kind of elevate the experience even beyond just what it can do from a business standpoint, I guess, for a song. There's something really beautiful artistically that can happen when a director's vision can coincide and collide with what you've done musically.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes it's very surprising. I never forget. I have this song called American Beauty, which is a bit of a classic version of, the older version of yourself looking back at the younger version of yourself and the one that got away, that broke, like the first heartbreak,
Yeah.
And there's a line in the song that says, "I wish I'd held her. I wish I'd held her longer." Well, around Christmas one year, my manager calls and says, "Hey, we just got a call that Dick's Sporting Goods wants to use American Beauty for their Christmas commercial." And I'm like, what in the world could this sad, broke heartbreak song have to do with Dick's Sporting Goods around Christmas?
It's about a
But
fishing pole, isn't it? He's, I wish
yeah, fishing pole, that's right.
I'd.
So I said, "Sure, well, let's see what it is." So at the time, my daughter, who's now 11, was a 1 year old, and the commercial starts with a basketball goal as a gift in the cul-de-sac. And in a quick 30 seconds, the girl grows up, right? So there's all these like quick scenes of her growing up. And then the final scene is the dad and mom giving her a hug as she gets in her car to drive away under the basketball goal. It's still there. And the line is saying, "I wish I'd held her. I wish I'd held her
Ugh.
longer."
She was deja vu. She was a catch 22. She was an American beauty. Her blue eyes shined in the summer sun. Her kiss felt like a loaded gun. Wish I had held her longer. Wish I had held her longer.
And so, me as a dad of a daughter, I'm sobbing watching this director's, complete imagination of my song for this thing. And I'm thinking, well, A, I need to go buy a basketball goal, but B, I'm never going to think of this song in the same way anymore, because now
Wow.
I'm going to associate it with my own kid, which again, the song is about the young girl that broke my heart as an 18-year-old. So yeah, to your point, you never know what your art is going to sort of how it's going to be reimagined and reused in sort of the popular imagination. And that's a fun part of this job.
Yeah. You said a phrase a minute ago that you put the work in on the kind of on the sync side, that you built relationships, that you made sure that people knew about your music. And there is a if you're going to be a singer songwriter, there is the art and there is the business, and it is called the music business. And I understand that when you first decided to pursue this, that was kind of a key thing in terms of kind of having your parents' blessing, was this idea of not just having a dream, but having a work ethic and having a plan. Talk a little bit about how that side of it has been a part of your career trajectory from the very beginning, and how that continues to be an important driver of how people even get to hear your art.
Yeah, I think there's always, like, growing up, you would hear a lot of artists really sort of look down their noses at the business side of it. Oh, I don't care about that. I don't know about that. Or, you know, you can't use my, even back to TV, like a lot of artists back in the heyday of rock and roll, you know, they would let their label do payola, but they wouldn't dare let a grocery store chain use their music to sell bananas, you know? So it's amazing how that sort of culture has changed. But no one told me that when I started trying to make it as a singer-songwriter that I was also starting a small business. And so obviously the learning curve is really intense on that. And it's so intense at times that I think it can be a distraction from the creative work itself. And I think it's really important for every artist, once they start to experience any sort of commercial attention or success, or songwriters, that you have to learn pretty quickly how to hold those two things in tension. And that's both from how do you schedule your time, to how do you make decisions in the studio about what you want a record to sound like. And it's really easy to let all of those voices creep in. And obviously, I do think that one of the things I always say, like when we're in the studio and we're kind of, you know, just messing around and not working, I start to, that's when all of a sudden the sort of, as also the label head, I'm like, who's paying for this? I'm like, all right, that's great. Let's get back to work. Everybody get back in your booth and let's start making a record here. That's how sort of it manifests itself for me is, you know, we're independent. We've sort of taken that risk on ourselves, which means you also have to pay attention to the budget and things like that. But also, we always try to make sure our decision making, the final decision, is made based on what's creatively the most authentic, while also not being fools, you know. And you know, actually, I heard Rick Rubin talking recently about how the audience comes last. And I love everything he's ever said, except for that. I was like, I completely disagree with that. I understand what he's talking about. But I think that in a lot of ways, the creativity is a conversation. It's not, I don't see myself as sort of the solo, you know, guru who's in the workshop coming up with something magic and then everybody else just is expected to like it. I feel like there's always been an ongoing conversation with the audience between an artist or a songwriter. You know, and I think there's an interesting tension in that. And the same applies to the business side of it. I think every songwriter who lasts a long time has had to make peace with paying attention to the business side of it, or else you completely get taken advantage of and you run out of money, or you get really sort of jaded and dissatisfied, and that's also okay. I think some people cannot handle the business relational side of it that is necessary to sustain it over a long period of time, or they have to bring in a large team to handle all that for them, and that's okay. They just get less of a piece of the pie. But everybody's personality and capacity is different in that way, and I really enjoy that part of it. But I also found myself at times distracted by it and having to reset and remember that the songs are what got me here in the first place, and I need to pay more attention to that than anything else.
Well, let's flip the coin over. I asked you to give us a little insight into the business side. I'd love to get a little insight into the creative side. Specifically, you talked about kind of that live forever moment was a bit of a breakthrough leading up to the Good Light album, which did really well for you guys. And one of the songs on that record, What Would I Do Without You, is one that has particularly caught hold with fans, and a song that seems to have really resonated.
I feel like I'm walking with eyes as blind as a man without a lantern in a coal mine. What would I do without you? My imagination gets the best of me, and I'm trying to hide lost at sea. What would I do without you? The difference between what I've said and done, and you're still standing by my side. A guilty soul and a worried mind. I will never make it if I'm on my own.
Take us behind the curtain of that song and just give us a little insight into the inspiration for that one and how you kind of put that together.
Yeah, well, there's this classic walk down that's in so many great songs that song has. You know, it's in Paul Simon's America. It's in Bob Dylan's You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go. And there was a bit of a trepidation about sort of taking this classic, you know, chord walk down that, again, is sort of massively spread throughout popular music history. But then at some point you just say, I don't care. It resonates with me. I love that walk. I love this piece of music, and I'm going to sort of repurpose it and for my own thing. And so this song came out of a particularly dark night of the soul, where I was having some sort of massive meta issues about like life, death, and family and meaning and, you know, God and all the pieces that keep us up at night sometimes when we're in a sort of a tough spot. And my wife was just incredibly present without creating any extra demand on me in that season. And so that song was just a very specific song about a song of sort of gratitude and an exploration of how she had and continues to stick by me in those moments. And it's interesting, but back to the sort of reimagination of it, the feedback I've gotten on the song over the years has been, obviously a lot of people see it in that same light. This is the song that people dedicate to their spouse or wedding song or whatever. But I've also heard from a guy who's like, man, this is the song about my dad who stuck by me when I was in rehab. You know, this is a song about my son who stuck by me when my wife died. Or I think there's a sort of universal thing to that. Now, what I love about this song is it doesn't have a chorus. It's an A B stanza song. You know, it rotates between these two forms and shapes. It has this little hook in the sort of A section that closes with the "What would I do without you?" But the lyric, that's the only lyric that repeats. And there was some disagreement in the studio about this song when we were recording it. Some people in the band and one of the co-producers was like, I don't know about this one, if it should make the record or not. And it was like, well, it's my record and I love the song, so we're going to record it. That same producer was mixing it a month later and had lost the love of his life due to some, you know, just a bad breakup kind of thing. And he was mixing the song that he didn't love that much and fell in love with the song, fell back in love with his girl and got it figured out. Now they've been married for almost 15 years. So, you know, I love that piece of the story, but it was a buried track on the record. It was in like the 11 or 12 spot. Wow. You know, which we all know as record makers means that like, this is a heart song. This is not going to be commercially viable because it doesn't have a chorus.
Right. Right.
And lo and behold, it's become our most sort of beloved song in our fan base. And, you know, it's interesting. I've sort of stuck to my guns a few times with some songs where I've had some disagreement about it. That's one of them. Another one's called Family. There were some lyrical disagreements about that inside of my camp. I stuck to my, you know, my guns on that song. Doesn't have a chorus either. It's just a shout repeat, you know, sort of deal. And so I don't know, just like, I love that some of the songs that I wrote alone and non-traditionally have become my fans' most favorite, just because it sort of satisfies the contrarian spirit in me as a creator. And but What Would I Do Without You is definitely my sort of desert island. If you get one song and the rest of them sort of disappear into the ether, that's the one I take with me.
Wow. Hey, Songcraft listeners, just a quick break from our talk with Drew Holcomb. I wanted to ask Scott a question, though. Scott, how do you like my new song?
Which one? I don't know if I knew about your new song.
Oh, you haven't heard it?
I have not.
That's because I don't have a demo for it.
Oh,
you know, I haven't gone to Pearl Snap Studios to get my demo made yet. I can't even ask you what you think about the song. I can't do anything with the song. The song lives in my head. That's the only place it lives because I haven't gone there yet.
Yeah, that's true. And usually when you do play me new songs, I almost always respond with the same comment, which is, man, good song. Great demo, though. Where did you get it done? And right. So often the answer is Pearl Snap Studios.
Yeah.
If you are a songwriter and you've got a song that you need to get a professional demo for at a price that is reasonable and affordable, I suggest going to check out our friend Justin and his team at Pearl Snap Studios. You can find them at pearlsnapstudios.com. Tell them that Songcraft sent you and you'll get a discount on your first demo.
I want to continue in the kind of nuts and bolts fashion of that question and ask you about the song Avalanche. You know, whenever I'm preparing for an interview, I do a bit of active listening and then a bit of passive listening, where I just sort of have the music on in the background and stuff. And I had the Medicine record on in the background, and I heard the song Avalanche. I'm like, oh, it's beautiful, you know? And there are so many moments when, you know, you and Ellie's voices blend together and create this sound that's this, so signature for you. Oh, what can I do? I try to hold it back. I want to make it last. Oh, I know it's true. I never stood a chance. Your love is like an avalanche. But I had this thought when I was listening to it. I was like, man, this melody feels like it's so written for the harmony. And there are times when you write a melody and then you find out, oh, this harmony elevates it. That's nice. And there are times when it feels like, when I listen to a song like Two of Us by the Beatles, and I'm like, that was written knowing that these two guys were going to sing it in lockstep together all the way. Do you write for the harmony at times? Is, you know, as a listener, was I noticing something right there? Or was that something you just wrote a melody and found out, oh, this sounds great when we sing it together?
But the long running joke and commentary inside of the neighbors and with my wife until about 5 years ago was that Drew couldn't sing a harmony if his life depended on it. Now in COVID, it's a long story, but it's going to make a point. I bought this piece of property outside of Nashville, and John Prine had just died from COVID. So this property was outside of cell service. And so I just made this 20 song John Prine playlist, and I would go out there once a week and cut these 15 acres on a, you know, on a ride mower. And I made myself learn to sing harmony.
Wow.
And now I love it. I love, somebody said, hey, will you jump up and sing harmony? I'm like, absolutely. I'm all in. I finally sort of clicked for me, and without any formal training, just listening to songs and forcing myself to sing them. That said, while I'm not a very good harmony singer historically, I always hear lots of harmonies. My biggest critique of a sound person is always when I see more than one person singing, but only hear one person singing.
Yeah.
I'm like, and especially when I know it's like the MD who's the backup singer, I'm like, I know he knows how to sing. Like,
yeah.
Turn it up, you know? And I always send these references of like all these Eagles records. I'm like, this is what I want the vocals to sound like. I want there to be harmonies. I definitely hear harmony in the sense that I hear a wall of vocals. You know, Avalanche was not one necessarily that I heard that on. I knew that it had any you know, these long sort of lilting, mm-hmm. you know, full note moments. It's like you definitely want there to be a stack of something else there. Ellie, my wife, is one of the most naturally gifted harmony singers I've ever met. It just comes out of her and oozes out of her. And so when I wrote that song, I wrote that song with a guy named Ian Fitchuk, who at the time was mainly doing session work here in Nashville and has since become this huge producer. He did Casey Musgrave's record that won Album of the Year at the Grammys and a bunch of other stuff since. And he and I wrote that song together. It was one of those, we just sat down, like, what do you want a song about? He's like, I've had this word that I just want to write a song about Avalanche, you know? And then came up with that Never Stood a Chance, Your Love Is Like an Avalanche. And we just thought, oh, we're kind of off to the races here. But he was the one who originally sang the harmony, and it was beautiful, but it was better with Ellie, just because there's a tonal thing that's happened between our voices for 20 years that is no one, you know, I haven't been able to find anybody else who can do it quite like her. Although my bass player, when she quit the band, all of a sudden we're like, man, what are we going to do about these harmony parts? And he's like, well, I can sing. It's like, I says, okay, let's hear it. So we did a song and he sang her part. And he wasn't as good as her, but I was like, what the heck, man? You could sing for 10 years and didn't tell me. He goes, you never asked.
That's funny. Well, as you mentioned, Avalanche was a co-write. And, you know, I look at an album like Dragons, and you've got songs on there co-written with people like Laurie McKenna and Natalie Himby, Zach Williams from The Lone Bellow, all Songcraft, previous Songcraft guests, by the way.
Nice.
So,
good alumni base.
Yeah. Now we're completing the circle. But talk a bit about co-writing and how working with different co-writers might bring out different sides of your musical personality. And as an asterisk to that, you also co-write with your wife. And I'd love to hear a bit about that dynamic when you sort of share life, but also you're sharing your profession, which also happens to be creativity. You know, that's an interesting thing. So just in a broad sense, kind of your thoughts on co-writing versus solo writing and how those different relationships kind of impact how you approach the process.
Yeah. I've completely declined co-writing for almost a decade because I had some really negative early experience with it, where I was writing with a handful of sort of professional hit makers who just really, I just felt multiple times like I brought great ideas that then got sort of chewed up into these songs that I couldn't stand. And so for a decade, I was like, I'm only co-writing with my wife and bandmates, no one else. Fast forward 10 years, we'd had some really good success with Good Light and with Medicine, most of which were completely written alone. There's a few exceptions where like Avalanche is the only co-write off of Medicine. I wrote it with, the guy who's playing drums in the sessions, So didn't hardly co-write at all for a decade. Then really hit a sort of creative and physical exhaustion point. And what brought me out of that was I met up with some friends of mine, a band named Johnny Swim out of LA, husband and wife duo who are just the best people, great songwriters. And we were going to do a tour together. And they said, well, if we're going to do a tour together, why don't we write a song? I went out to LA. This is right around like 48 hours after the Charlottesville race, riot that happened. And they're both people of color. Man is an African American. Abner's a Cuban American, and we wrote this just absolute banger of an angry protest song about sort of people from our sort of religious background who were, excusing the behavior of white supremacists. And it was just disgusting. And we wrote this song called Ring the Bells that really was just a banger of a song. Not only did it sort of express all the anger inside of us, but it also was really fun to sing and perform and write. And we had a couple more songs together. And all of a sudden, it's like the door that I had locked got kind of cracked. And then I just decided to push it wide open and walk through it. And I had had people, I met Laurie McKenna singing in a round. And after we did the round, she's like, I love your songs. We should write together someday. That was 5 years earlier than this. And I'd never taken her up on it. And there were a number of people like that, other artists, people like Jack Williams or Sean McConnell. And what I did for that for Dragons was I just said yes. I'm gonna say yes to co-writing with people, and I'm gonna call these legendary writers who are friends of mine, who've offered to write with me, and say, "All right, I'd love to write with you." And so I wrote Maybe with Natalie Himby. I wrote You Want What You Can't Have with Laurie McKenna. I wrote End of the World with Sean McConnell, but then I also wrote half the re that record by myself. And so it was a nice, it sort of found a nice balance because what I found. I'm still not good at writing for writing's sake. I really have a hard time writing a song if I don't know who's going to sing it. I've written a lot with people who nowadays are just like, well, let's just write a good one, see what happens. I'm like, I don't even know what that means.
Right.
Because I find that the singer, the vessel of the deliverer of the song sort of is what makes it believable and whether it has that real ache to it or not, But I've carried that with me forward. And so I've done a lot of co-writing. It's primarily with people knowing that it's for my record. I don't do a lot of other writing. But on Strangers No More, I wrote two songs with Ketch Secor from Old Crow Medicine Show, who's a friend and a neighbor. Kids go to school together. Kevin Rhodes and I wrote two songs on the record, one called Find Your People, one called Way Back When. That's that we kind of put out after the fact. But I think the co-writing thing, because these are people that know me, they sort of have a little bit of a, oh, I'd love to hear you try this. I've always wondered what it would be like if you sang something like this, or if you had a song that felt like this. And so a great example of that would be All the Money in the World. Dave Barnes, who's an old friend who's much more of sort of pop sensibilities. I'm more Dylan, he's more Stevie Wonder kind of vibe as a writer. And he's like, you're from Memphis. I would love to hear you sing just like a classic sort of Memphis soul 70s pop song. And we did it and we it worked really well. And so it forced me to step outside of myself, both from writing, but then also in studio and live, Now I have a couple songs in the set where I'm not even holding a guitar. This is very revelatory for me.
Right.
So I really have enjoyed that. There's a confidence that comes with getting older. You know who you are, and you know you're not going to get sort of chipped away at in those creative sessions because you know how to stand up for yourself. And I've got enough sort of, I don't know, of a career that I can get the right, I get to kind of sort of pick and choose these folks that are good friends of mine that I get to spend time writing songs with. I do think that'll actually increase as I get older, because my plan is to tour less and to write more. Because I really do like it. I love the writing part. Has become more magical to me than it used to, maybe even more so than the stage piece. And then, you know, the question about writing with Ellie, for years, we didn't write together at all. It was just a hot zone in the marriage, you know, to come in, because we both had some wounds from previous sort of experiences with it, but we were also at the same time each other's biggest cheerleaders. And that was legitimately true. She writes these sort of faith-based confessional storyteller songs that are beautiful and epic. And I, you know, and she loves to collaborate. Almost all of her records, she'll have 12 songs and 10 of them will be co-writes. You know, she just loves collaborating. Whereas, you know, for me, and she'll also write 40 songs for record, I'll write 20, you know, and pick 10 or 12. So, and I'm quite a bit more picky. She's a melody first writer. I'm a lyric first writer. I don't care what the melody is until I know what we're saying, you know? And she's like, I don't care what we're saying until we have a good melody. So that created some oil and water experience for us, but we've really come out of that. We actually had a tour together in February. We do an acoustic tour every year, and we brought a friend of ours on the road to write for 4 days, and in 4 days, I think we wrote like 6 songs. Wow. And we've really found a nice rhythm of creating together, and hope to sort of really start running a third. We've been running parallel careers for, you know, a decade now, or 12 years since she left the band. And we're going to add a third rail of actually making full length records together, not just a song here and there. But I'm sure there will be a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in that too, even though it is going a lot better than it has historically.
Yeah.
Well, you know, even hearing the way you described the process of sort of getting to a song like Live Forever, when you were kind of separating yourself from the commercial headspace, right, in your writing. And it sounds like purity matters to you when it comes to art and the way it sort of passes through you as a vessel. Because I feel like art sort of shows up to all of us in a really pure way when we're kids, when we hear it and see it and experience it for the first time. And then all these other influences and all these other motivations start to creep in and sort of change the relationship we have with it. But it sounds very different when you say, I got in a room with some hit writers. And then you say, I got in a room with some hit writers who are friends. And the relational part of it seems like it has a lot to do with making that a pure experience rather than just a transactional experience.
Yeah. I don't even know if I can do that. I've done it a handful of times, and every time I just felt like, what am I doing? I don't even feel like myself right now. And it's not necessarily that I feel like everybody can get to that space if they want to. Every creative, every writer I ever met with has that gear.
Yeah.
But whether they choose to sort of stay in that is a preference thing. I mean, a lot of the greatest writers in town, you know, some of my favorite writers in town, you know, I mean, Stapleton's like one of these examples people always bring up. You know, he had these like huge sort of pop country, whatever hits. And then he puts out these like insanely authentic records. It's like, well, still the same person. Like, right. We're all complex individuals who, you know, are capable of, you know, I defend we did this in the round. Ellie and I did an in the round on Death Row with the Warren brothers, who are these great, you know, country writers who people like have loved to, they write some of the songs that like people love to make sort of poke fun at, like Red Solo Cup. And over the years, I've become a massive defender of that song. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. This song is a bunch of guys who got really drunk one night. We're like, let's put the best of our songwriting talents together and write a song about this dumb thing that we all know all about starting at age 17.
Yeah.
And it's this great anthem that actually I think really penetrates a really particularly special part of being a human, which is, you know, the irony of shared experience over stupid things. And to sing our songs, Ellie's, I mean, we, Ellie and I weren't singing necessarily together at this in the round. She was doing her own songs as well. We were backing each other up, and then they were doing their songs. And I mean, we're playing for some of these guys who are in really tough, they're in a tough spot, and they've made some really poor choices in their lives, but music was just electric that night. And to see what songs can mean to even people who are in the worst potential way to be alive, you know, in high sort of security, maximum prison, waiting for, you know, the worst. It was a really interesting experience in what music is. And so while I have my personal preferences about songs, I have become a fan of anyone who steps out into this space to give themselves away and give their talents away. And like you said, sort of have creativity flow through them to write songs and to sort of take this risk, take this chance. My personal listening preferences would be, you know, more of the sort of heart on their sleeve, very authentic, vulnerable type writers. But I have enormous respect and admiration, and I'm a fan of many writers whose music I would have probably hated 10 to 20 years ago.
Yeah, I've told this story before, but there was a guy when I was probably in college who was a exceptional musician. He was a little older than me and unbelievable musician. And I was kind of trying to like impress him a little bit. And so I made some snide remark about Shania Twain's songs, you know, and I wanted to like let him know that, you know, I was sophisticated or whatever. And he said, "Yeah, you go try to write a song that sounds that simple." And I was like, "Oh,
whoops!"
realigned my viewpoint a little bit. So yeah. So in 2021, you put out a single called "Without a Light," and that's another one that kind of just really has caught on and appealed to a lot of listeners. And would love to hear a bit about how you know, what inspired that song and writing that one.
Yeah, that's a fun story. I mean, there's a handful of songs in the catalog that were written by Rich or Nathan, who had now been with me for 20 years. I didn't know Rich could write a song until 6 or 7 years ago. He showed up, we were making that album Souvenir, and I said, let's try to write some songs together. And he's like, all right. And we wrote this song called Postcard Memories that was really his idea. And I was like, man, this is insanely good. And so I've asked him to keep sending me songs. He writes about 2 a year. And, you know, one of them will be about as good as Without a Light. And so it was during COVID, and we had recorded it for like a demo thing. And I just kept coming back to it and asked him if we could release it. And he said yes. And we put it out just as a random single in the middle of COVID. And all of a sudden it got picked up on like every single sort of coffee house, you know, afternoon chill, whatever playlist. And then all of a sudden our fans sort of took onto it, and it's become this really, really popular song.
When we drink wine, you have a way to slow the motion in my mind. All the while can turn me back to you in mid-flight. It's hard to find your way without a light. What's the point in living out my days without you?
There's another one on Strangers No More called On a Roll that Nathan, the guitar player, wrote. And what's been interesting about being in a band for 20 years together is that they really know, they now, not only do they know my voice, they are a part of my voice, musically speaking. Hardly do anything creative without them involved. And so for them to sort of offer up, they also, neither one of them has any ambition of being a singer and artist themselves. And so it's kind of a nice combination because they do write these great songs that we've used every now and then. I wish I could convince them to write more often. And if they listen to this, come on guys, write more songs. But yeah, it's a song that he wrote, sort of a similar sort of thing. And I don't want to speak too much for him, but was written at when one of those dark nights of the soul where you're like, man, if I didn't have this person, I'd be in a tough spot. I'd be in the dark. And, it's also like 2 minutes and 20 seconds. And it's one of those songs where I was like, is this just a demo? Where's the rest of it? And he's like, that's the song. That's all you get. You know, we're going to leave it at that.
You know, you talked about them sort of understanding your voice, and I guess the voice of the band in a way. And we talked about, you know, the songs you did, the kind of reaching into the Memphis-ness of your background. And, you know, there's some rockers, there's some acoustic stuff, but there is a sound. You know, you guys have a sound, and there's a vibe. And I'm sure there are moments when you get to something, and you're about halfway through it, and you're like, this is outside the vibe. Like, I like this, but I don't think we can put it on this band's project. I'd actually like to ask you, what songs have you put out that you're like, those are at the farthest reaches I will go? That is the rockin'est song I'm going to do. Or that is the countryest song I'm going to do. Or that is the, you know, are there songs that you can identify right away? Those are at the edges of what I'll put out.
Yeah, I can. And honestly, what's interesting is I can almost, without a question about them, actually pulling up, when I look at my albums, there's almost every single album has a song that I wish we, you know, and I know you're not supposed to say this kind of thing out loud, but there, we have come to this conclusion. There's a song on almost every record that I kind of wish wasn't on the record. Huh. And so for instance, on Medicine, that's a song called The Last Thing We Do. And part of that is just the way we went for it. Like the way we produced it. But it's just like, honestly, we were stretching into like, let's do the biggest Springsteen-y thing we can. Right. And it didn't really match the rest of the vibe. And, you know, so there's definitely like, to your point, it's definitely at the edge of what we do.
Right.
Maybe we even went a little too far, which, you know, it's, to be able to like admit that, I think is just getting older and being okay with yourself. I'm trying to find a record, Dragons. There's definitely one on Dragons too that we feel that way about. No, actually Dragons is the one, because we only did 10 songs. We really made ourselves sort of take it easy on that. But there's a song on there that our fans definitely, I think, wish we hadn't put on there because no one listens to it. A song called Make It Look So Easy. and then on Souvenir, it's a song called Black and Blue we just don't love it. I think every time that we hear it, we like kind of look at each other like, man, well, why did we put that on that record?
Isn't it crazy now that you can actually, you can look at the metrics now of Spotify and see what people are listening to, where before, to find out what fans really thought, you had to tour Germany. You know, like to actually totally hear what people thought of your songs.
That's so true. That's so true. Yeah, sometimes that data is like a little too much information, yeah. You know?
No offense to our German listeners, by the way, but
then there's also songs that I know that my fans don't love that much that I don't care, because they mean so much to me. There's a song on Souvenir called Rowdy Heart Broken Wing, which has never really caught any sort of cultural zeitgeist, but it's a song I wrote in an airport hotel in Amsterdam, waiting on a flight that was leaving early the next morning. I just got off the phone with my brother, who is now 7 years sober, but at the time had just come out of rehab and was just really struggling with what his future was going to be. And I just got off the phone and wept and wrote this song for him and sent it to him. And the fact that I put it on a record and gave it away to the world as well is just like, whatever, it's gravy. That song means the world to my brother. Because it's like me speaking for him in a way that he didn't know how to quite speak for himself, because he's not a musician. And so that's something he has like forever, and that I have, that I gave him forever.
I got a rowdy heart and a broken wing, restless nights and the strangest dream, staring at the sky, begging for some relief.
I don't care if that song never gets used in a TV moment, or gets like, it's not even really a great live song. It's super quiet, very chill. But I don't care. That's a song I wrote for him. And I would give up a lot of my popular songs to keep that one.
Wow. Yeah. See, you're more like Rick Rubin than you think.
I did care about the audience, though. Just one guy.
Right, there you go. Fair point. Strangers No More. You've mentioned it a couple times. We've talked about it. Your most recent full length studio album with the band. You know, when you are an independent artist and you are kind of driving the train, so to speak. What is it for you as a songwriter and creative? How do you know? What's the internal clock that says, you know what, it's time to go to the studio and make another record? Because you don't have somebody saying, all right, well, come on, we need this. Like you're kind of using your internal compass, so to speak, to say, I have the songs, I know what I want to say, these songs fit together, it's time. Is that something that you can even articulate, or is it just an instinct?
The rhythm for me has been when I have two or three songs that are unreleased that I can't keep a secret anymore, that I have to, I'm like compelled to put them out, whether that's because I start playing them live and people love them or I love them. So on this record, that the two songs that sort of pushed this record into existence were Fly and Gratitude, which that also tends to be the case for me. Those songs tend to be sort of the softer ones from a sonic perspective. That's a lot of times where like the deepest part of my sort of vulnerability is when I write something in a mode like Fly or Gratitude. But when I have those and I want people to hear them, it's sort of like, well, you got to build a frame for it. And I'm old school. We got to make a record, you know? I love the moment in time that a record is from the way a record sounds. We tend to record most everything sort of live and in the room and then go back and sort of add to it. But there's a lot of magic that happens there. And all of my records, I think, sort of have a sort of particular sonic identity, which I'm proud of that. Now, that said, I do put out singles every now and then, put out songs, but a lot of times it's because that song doesn't feel like it is not like a launching pad for a whole project. Like a song like I Need to Go Somewhere was a song about being stuck at home in COVID and it had to come out immediately.
Right.
And it wasn't really writing anything else. And so I just put it out. But when I have those two or three songs that I just can't keep a secret anymore, I know it's time to do the work and write another 20 and put a record together.
Yeah. Amazing. We ask people on here all the time. We say, what's your favorite song of yours that you've written? And no one can ever give us an answer. And you have already told us your favorite song you've written, and you've gone so far as to tell us exactly which songs you wish you could kill from previous albums. So I love your directness and your honesty. It's been a lot of fun to talk with you and just, kind of get an overview of your process and your career. So Drew, thank you for spending time with us.
Yeah, well, it's an honor, and I appreciate you guys digging into this thing that we obviously mutually love and have built our lives on. So it's fun to talk shop with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Songcraft, please take a moment right now to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can keep up with us on Instagram at Songcraft Conversations or Facebook at Songcraft Show. To join our team and help support our content, become a Songcraft patron at patreon.com. Visit patreon.com/songcraftshow.
And you can always find us at songcraftshow.com.